From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, how a local scientist's approach to autism research differs from most other labs.
We're trying to understand autism in terms of the neural computational deficits that might occur in the disorder, or changes that occur in the disorder.
Then we learn about who the real George Washington was when he was a boy and a young man.
If his father hadn't died so young, he would have been more anchored in the world, more sure of himself, really. But he was so determined to make a name for himself.
And our Fit for You segment explores the Orange Theory workout. It's all about your heart rate displayed on the big screen.
Having the heart rate feedback, I think, helps people on both sides. The members find that they are very much motivated by having the heart rate feedback up there. They're able to sometimes see that they can sometimes push harder than they might have once thought before.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Scientists at universities around the country often rely on outside money to fund their research, and this can pose some challenges. Often, financial grants and awards come with a lot of strings attached, which can limit how and what scientists study.
But the Shaw Scientist Award is a bit different. Named for the late Milwaukee attorney James Shaw, this award is given to a scientist rather than a specific research project. Ari Rosenberg is one of the 2018 recipients and explains to Lake Effect's Joy Powers what makes this award so unique.
So the award is Shaw Scientist Award. And the Shaw Scientist Award is it's specifically for young investigators, so new scientists at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And every year they award two of these to individuals who they think are doing interesting work that is pushing boundaries in ways that might not necessarily get funding right away.
What exactly did you submit for the award?
So Shaw's a little bit different. I think in part their interest is in funding the scientist so much as funding a specific project. So whereas other grant agencies will request a proposal for a very specific project, the Shaw wants a broader scope about what is the theme of your research, what are specific aspects of projects you're currently working on, and then where do you see it going? So the Shaw is unrestricted in how the funds get used, whereas other grants are highly restricted in the sense that you have to do that project that you proposed.
Now, what does that freedom really mean for you specifically with the kind of work that you're doing?
Yeah, so it kind of bridges computational or theoretical neuroscience and empirical research working with kids with autism or autism spectrum disorders. And this research, we try to understand specific behaviors that where there's demonstrations of some consequence in autism. So one example that we're working on now is contextual learning. So one area that kids with autism often have difficulties is going from one environment to another environment and changing their behaviors to match that environment. So for example, being on a playground versus being in a classroom requires very different behaviors. What we would like to do is understand how the brain processes that contextual information and uses it to guide your behavior.
So by contextual learning, you mean based on the context of the situation, how they learn to behave
right. Based
on context.
That's right. So how do you look around an environment or a scene and decide how should I behave? So if you're in a classroom, you have your desks, there's a teacher at the front of the room, the teacher tells you to sit down and pay attention, and so you sit down and pay attention and you start processing the information that the teacher is presenting. In a different environment, say in a playground, there's slides and swings and kids are running around, and so this is all information that says, okay, well, I can now run around and have fun on the playground rather than be in a structured environment of a classroom. So how do you guide your behavior based on those events and the things happening around you?
So what kind of studies have you done to date to kind of analyze contextual learning?
Yeah, so we're doing a study now with adolescents with autism and typical development. And we can't, of course, study in an unstructured environment like a playground or in a classroom. This is poses a number of challenges in terms of setting up a rigorous, structured study. So what we do is we develop basically computer learning games where we have kids come to the lab for several sessions, and we have them do a task in which we embed information. And we don't tell them about this information that we've embedded, and we look how their behavior is modulated over time. So we look to see, do they start to use the information that we've embedded and in a way that makes sense to improve their performance on a task? This might be, for example, a visual search task where they'll see a cluttered scene and they have to find a particular target, like a specific letter or a shape or something like a Disney character.
Of course, we talked about the kind of freedom that this new money really means for you. Have there been studies that you've wanted to do in the past that you haven't been able to because you weren't able to get the funding that you think you'll be able to do now?
Yeah, so that great question. So my background is in computational neuroscience, and what that basically means is I look at the brain as if it's an engineer that has to solve a specific problem. And so a good example of this is if you have two cameras each taking slightly different pictures of the same scene, how can you take those images and triangulate an object's position to, say, guide a robotic arm to grab the object? And so we look at the brain as the same way that you have, instead of two cameras, you have two eyes, and you have to take in this visual information to triangulate positions of objects to be able to successfully reach and grab them if you want to interact with them. And so our approach to understanding autism is different than many other labs' approaches in the sense that we're trying to understand autism in terms of the neural computational deficits that might occur in the disorder or changes that occur in the disorder. Our experiments are actually motivated by seeing how we can develop neural network models and alter parameters of those models to reproduce specific behaviors. And something that's coming out of this work is that we can actually account for a lot of the behavioral consequences of autism in terms of alterations in a single computation, which basically controls how the activity of different neurons influences each other. And this is a rather interesting idea because it suggests that we might be able to come up with a more unified framework for understanding autism. And this is a bit unusual because typically we look at autism as this highly heterogeneous disorder. And so these kinds of heterogeneities in the disorder have led many people in the field to think that there is no hope of finding a unified framework for understanding the disorder. And so there's some resistance to funding research that will attempt to come up with a unified framework. It's just, it doesn't make intuitive sense to a lot of individuals. But based on our neural network modeling and the behavioral studies that we have completed, we have some strong evidence that suggests that we will be able to come up with a unified framework for understanding the disorder. And so with these kinds of funds, we're actually able to directly test this.
Now, when you say a unified framework, can you kind of describe that for me as someone who is not a neuroscientist and is lost in a bit of the jargon? When you talk about like a unified framework, what does that mean?
Yeah, so when you look at a population of individuals with a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder, so spectrum disorder already starts to give the idea that it's not homogeneous, right? That not everybody that has the disorder has the same behavioral deficits or consequences. So what is the reason for this behavioral heterogeneity? One possibility is that different parts of the brain, different individuals are impacted differently to give rise to the behavioral consequences that get called under the umbrella of autism and autism spectrum disorder. One way of thinking about this is that it's just that different parts of the brain might be impacted differently. Different individuals might be impacted differently. And so there's no single cause or single root that you could use to say, okay, well, this is what causes ASD. From our perspective, we can understand many of the behavioral consequences of the disorder in terms of specific computations that the brain has to perform and changes or alterations in those in the same computation across different brain regions.
So essentially, you're coming up with a kind of formula for the different ways that people might respond. Is that a formula for the disorder, as it were, and how it leads to people responding differently?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So one way of thinking about this, so all the differences across individuals who have autism is a consequence of different formulas being altered in each individual. The formulas that govern how you take in sensory information and produce a behavioral response, that formula is altered in different ways across individuals. And from our perspective, what we hypothesize is that it's actually the same change happening in different formulas.
Now, this is a big question, I realize, but what is the end goal of this research? What are you hoping to find kind of at the end of it?
Well, one of the really nice things that's coming out of the work that we're doing is that we can actually subgroup individuals with autism into very distinct clusters. And what this means for these individuals is that we have an opportunity to better individualize their treatment plans. So instead of looking at autism as a single homogeneous entity that you have to treat in the same way, which we all know is incorrect, we need to instead individualize treatment plans. So tailor those treatment plans to the individual. But this is problematic because you need to find ways to subgroup in an efficient and meaningful manner. And so one of the main results of our work is developing behavioral and quantitative metrics that allow us to actually do that subgrouping.
So instead of treating a million people a million different ways, you can treat a million people in five, six different kind of ways.
Yeah, our hope is that we can create these kinds of behavioral clusters that will do a better job of individualizing those treatment plans. Moving forward, we're actually hoping to start working with clinicians to take these behavioral metrics to guide treatment plans for their patients.
Ari Rosenberg, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and talking about your work.
Thank you, Joy.
Ari Rosenberg is an assistant professor for the Department of Neuroscience at UW-Madison. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Rosenberg is also one of the recipients of this year's Shaw Scientist Awards, and you can find out more at WUWM.com.
Coming up after a break, we learn the tales of the real young George Washington when we talk with author and Wisconsin native Peter Stark. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Most of us learned many of the details of our nation's founding in our history classes, from the Articles of Confederation to the Continental Congress, the Declaration of Independence, and battles such as Valley Forge and Yorktown. But while we might think we know about our founding fathers, there are large parts of their lives that aren't found in many of our history books.
Writer and Wisconsin native Peter Stark knew what we all knew about George Washington. Stark's writing specialties are adventure and history, and during some time in the relatively wild reaches of western Pennsylvania, he discovered it was a place that a young George Washington had some experiences that informed the leader he became. Stark set out to learn more, and the result is his recent book, Young Washington. He joined us in the studio recently. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Mitch.
Most of us probably have this image of George Washington as being kind of from this, you know, lauded, noble English family. But from what you write, that really does not seem to be the case. So what was George Washington's upbringing like and his ancestry?
He has a really interesting ancestral background. Basically, the short version is that the Washington family had been trying to climb to the upper echelons of the aristocracy for centuries, first in England and then in Virginia. And with remarkable consistency, they had not made it. The Washington men tended to marry wealthy landed widows. The men would rise in status to gentleman status. They'd have like 18 children. The wealth would disperse and they'd kind of sink back down. George Washington's great-grandfather essentially got shipwrecked in Virginia on a trading venture. Married a magistrate's daughter. Magistrate gave him 700 acres of land, you know, so here's the wealthy, fortuitous marriage. And that established the Washingtons. And so for the next four generations until George was born in 1732, they were tobacco planters at kind of a middling level. And George was very ambitious to climb out of that.
That was really what sets George apart, is his ambition.
Incredible ambition. It's very notable from the time he's a teenager. And one of the things I've felt about in all my exposure to this part of his life is that his father died when he was 11, and his older brother, whom he revered, died when he was in late teens, and he was never very close to his mother. And I've thought that if his father hadn't died so young, he would have been more anchored in the world, more sure of himself, really. But he was so determined to make a name for himself.
Well, and so well before he is a founding father, he is a surveyor. There is a lot of land out there with which to survey. But give us a sense for, you know, what the role of surveyors was in, you know, the 1740s and 50s.
Well, you can imagine that in the 1740s and 50s, that's basically 100 years after the Jamestown landings, a little more than that. And the British population was still very much confined to the Atlantic coast. Yet there was a huge stretch of land that lay just over the Appalachian Mountains and the Appalachian foothills and over the mountains. And George started surveying that as a teenager. So he developed very early almost a lust for land. All these Virginia planters were very much about land. And he had a real sense of acquisition for land.
Well, so from that, what is the turn of events that leads to his journey, you know, well to the Northwest to deliver a message to the French commandant in what I guess is now probably the area around Erie, Pennsylvania?
Right. And so, George, you know, when we think of coastal the Atlantic and coastal Virginia, so that's where the British colonies are, of course, the colonies that we know. And then up in Canada, there were the French, and they had, you know, their colony there that dated back to the early 1600s also. So in between was a huge area known as the Ohio wilderness. And it's not just the Ohio we think of today, not the state. It would encompass Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Virginia, on and on and on. It's an area almost the size of France. So in the about 1753, George had just, as a 21-year-old, signed up to be a young officer in the Virginia militia as another way to advance his standing and his career. And he was still surveying. And he was doing a little planting. And He signed up for this job and this post. And at that point, just then, the British governor of Virginia, Virginia Colony, of course, Governor Dinwiddie, heard that the French were building forts out in the vast Ohio wilderness. And Governor Dinwiddie needed someone to deliver a message to the French, basically saying, stay out, all these lands belong to King George. George Washington raised his hand. He had some frontier experience. Governor Dinwiddie dispatched him and sent him over the Appalachian Mountains in late 1753 with a wilderness guide, Christopher Gist. They hit terrible snowstorms crossing the mountains. They were on horseback. They had servants. They got way back into the wilderness after a terrible journey, and they came to a French post. It was greeted by a French officer who said, oh, man, you're in the wrong place. I kind of brushed George off. And remember, George is only 21 years old, and he has no military experience. Very ambitious. And brushes him off, says, oh, you got to ride a week that way to my boss. And so George and Gist and their party do, and through, you know, swamps and mud and rain and snow and on, and get to a larger French post recently built. And there is a distinguished gentleman, elderly gentleman soldier, French commandant, who greets George with, you know, the formal dinner and candlelight and red wine, which is imported from France, and wonderful meats, and the whole formal greeting, and then reads the letter and goes into another room and writes a reply and sends George off. And George goes thrashing back through the wilderness at high speed because Governor Dinwiddie has told him to go with all urgency. And George ends up leaving his horses, which are failing because they can't find enough feed in the snow and the streams are frozen, and he almost dies falling off a raft into a river and all these incredible harrowing adventures. It's amazing he made it. And he gets back to Governor Dinwiddie and hands him the letter. And the letter says, from the French commandant, well, our nations are finally at peace. You know, this is after they've been at war for 700 years. And I would very much like to keep the peace. However, as to your request that I should leave, I don't think so. And that's where the real trouble begins.
Well, and what's interesting, a lot of it is interesting, but, you know, of all the people to take on this mission, this is a guy that, you know, he had some frontier experience, but he was not a wilderness expert.
He was not. No.
Not a diplomacy expert either.
Neither of those things. I mean, George starts whining when he first goes into the wilderness that there are no linen tablecloths on the tables of the frontier settlers in their log cabins, and their table manners are terrible. They just eat with a knife, and their bed bugs and blah, blah, blah. So he has, you know, he's learning. And so he has very, at first, very little wilderness experience and no military experience. And that really gets him into a great deal of trouble when Governor Dinwiddie, having read this letter, sends him back into the wilderness at the head of a small military party and to essentially deliver a firmer message to the French. And Governor Dinwiddie warns George, do not be the aggressor and be cautious. George, in his naked ambition, proceeds to do exactly the opposite. He ends up ambushing a small party of French who are having breakfast in a wooded glen on a rainy dawn. And George and his men open fire, and they end up killing a number of these French. George takes the rest of the French prisoner, about 20, 25 prisoners. And you'd think at this point, a sensible commander would pause, that this did not go exactly as planned. But George doesn't. He just brazenly pushes ahead, and he's very cocky. He says, well, if the French can put up no more fight than this, I'll drive them back to damn Montreal. And he writes to his brother, I mean, really right after this terrible incident, he writes to his brother and says, I heard bullets whistling, and believe me, there's something charming in the sound. And eventually that got back to King George, who responded, he would not say so if he'd heard many. But what happens is that George ends up getting essentially slaughtered by the French and the Indians and has to surrender, and terrible experience. And this is what touches off the French and Indian War.
How does the transformation take place then from this cocky guy who really, you know, believes a lot in himself without necessarily having the wisdom and the experience to back it up, to a guy who really does come up with the gravitas that one needs to become the commander of the Continental Army?
You know, it's a great question and a really interesting transformation. There are several key moments and events, and the patterns that I see is that he first, instead of being so self-promoting, just remarkably self-promoting and ambitious and whiny and petulant, complaining about officers who are ranked above him and not enough pay and he's underappreciated and he's going to quit. He threatens to quit seven times and quits some of them. It goes on and on like that. But he eventually gets put in charge of the Virginia regiment, almost 1,000 men at age 23, very young. And he's responsible for protecting these frontier settlers over a 350-mile long frontier, which I compare to the Afghanistan-Pakistan frontier of today, an almost impossible task to defend. Through this process, he sees his own men get slaughtered and lying dead in mud and blood in trenches. And, you know, these guys who are his age, who he's been responsible for, he's marched them into this situation, and now they're lying dead all around him. And you see George's sense of empathy start to grow, first towards the men he's leading. And he's also very good about at a certain point he shifts over and he literally at one point gets down off his horse. And, you know, that's a big thing for a Virginia gentleman to do. And he starts, you know, kind of getting down in the mud and pushing cannons up mountainsides with his men. And, you know, really he really gets down there in the dirt with them, which is they really bond with that. And then there's no sense no doubt that he has whatsoever, that he has this incredible bravery. You know, he is utterly fearless. No one ever doubted that about him from the very beginning. And incredibly fortunate at the same time for what he survives. So at one point the British finally do send a big army of redcoats into the wilderness under General Braddock. It's a famous incident in colonial history. They get ambushed by the Indians and the French. They don't even see the Indians. You know, they're behind trees and they just drop like flies in the middle of the road.
Traditional rules of engagement not applying.
The general is marching along saying, "Well, there's and the officers are saying, "Well, we can't have a battle here. There's no place to have a battle. So why would we worry?" And of course, the Indians. That's what they do. They fight in that terrain, and it's just again terrible slaughter of hundreds and hundreds. And George is kind of the last officer standing. It's called Braddock's Defeat, this famous battle, and he's a young aide de camp to General Braddock, and he rides around delivering messages from the general who's wounded. And George has horses shot out from under him, and then at the end of the battle, he looks at his hat and his coat. And he has four bullet holes through his hat and his coat. And he immediately, again, you know, his response to that is he writes a letter to his brother and says, "Divine providence protected me beyond all human expectation." And at that moment, you know, through that event, one really gets a sense that George starts seeing a larger role for himself, that he's being protected for a reason. And then I think the final thing that's really marked to me is that when he finally does leave the wilderness at age 26 and the British finally pry the French and Indians out of there, George immediately quits. He wants to go back to being a planter. He quits. Within a few weeks of leaving the wilderness, he marries Martha, who's what else? The richest widow in Virginia who has 17,000 acres of land and dozens and dozens and dozens of slaves, which, you know, of course, is a form of wealth in that those days, that society. And his marriage to Martha instantly brings him up to the top of the Virginia aristocracy. So he doesn't have to worry about his social status anymore. He doesn't really have to worry so much about money. And then I think even more important that Martha gives him this sense of emotional reassurance, and that which he didn't have growing up as a younger man, as an adolescent, as a youth. And George kind of settles down. He becomes a planter for almost 15 years. And then, you know, then we get into the story that we know is that this French and Indian War, which is spread around the globe, known as the Seven Years' War, which started right with George Washington's musket and orders right there. This war finally ends in 1763. 2 years later, in 1765, the British say, "We spent so much money protecting you American colonists. We're feeling really broke, so we're going to put this tax on you guys, the Stamp Act." It causes huge uproar in the colonies, and then the British revoke it, but they add more taxes later, and, you know, we know the story from there. Meanwhile, George is Virginia planter, you know, prosperous, and he's a Virginia, like a legislator. And when things really start heating up, there are the Continental Congresses, and George is a representative from Virginia, one of several. And he goes to the Continental Congress held in May and June of 1775, right after the battles of Lincoln and Concord. The Continental Congress is putting together an army to march against the British in Boston. And they look around the room, they're in Philadelphia, and say, "Who's going to lead this thing?" And, you know, you got short John Adams there, and like a lawyer, a mouthy lawyer from Boston, and he's not a wilderness guy.
Not really a recipe for success, no.
And people look around the room, and there's this quiet, tall guy who carries himself with a sort of regal bearing, who knew the gift of silence. And George has always had a thing for uniforms. So he's recently designed a new officer's uniform for the county militia down in Fairfax County. And George at the Continental Congress is sitting there silently with this regal bearing and wearing this incredibly beautiful officer's uniform with all the gewgaws and spangles and braids. And people look over and say, "There's our guy." So unanimously, they choose him to be our first commander in chief.
And amazing to think of this guy who was petulant and threatened to quit seven times as being the same guy who in whatever it was, the 1790s, you know, steps down from the presidency for the good of the country.
Exactly. I think, you know, that this image that we have of George Washington, that I think it's actually done the image that we've propagated in history, I think it's really done a big disservice to Americans and especially younger Americans, that we have this sense of this, you know, guy who's born, you know, selfless, faultless judgment, flawless, you know, sort of an immaculately conceived man-god who arrives on the scene and he leads, you know, the colonies to independence and becomes the first president. And that's not the way it happened at all. I mean, he thrashed and he struggled and he made mistakes and he failed, but he learned from them. And so this more vulnerable, more accessible George Washington is one that I find far more inspirational than this distant statue that we have. And I also think it's a real example both for youth and, you know, where we talk about today, you know, in our country, in our Congress, worldwide, you know, enormous crisis of leadership. And here's an example of someone who started out very flawed and he worked at it, he overcame it, and he became this great, and he was this selfless leader who stepped down saying, I don't want to be king. I just want to make this country work. And then he stepped down.
One of those cases where the true story is actually far more interesting and far better than the myth.
It's true, yes. I think exactly that the true story, it has so much more of a human component, and it's one that I think that we as flawed mortal citizens with all our weaknesses can relate to a lot better than this guy who just strides on the scene and magically leads things to this incredible place.
Peter Stark, it's a great story, and you tell it so well. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Mitch. It's been really fun.
Peter Stark's latest book is called Young Washington, How Wilderness and War Forged America's Founding Father. Stark grew up around Pine Lake in Waukesha County, but now calls Montana home.
One last break, and then our Fit for You segment explores the high-intensity exercise program called Orange Theory Fitness. That's when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
3 minutes in, Fred. That's one quarter of the way through. At this point, we should be feeling uncomfortable. So you're talking to that person next to you. 3 to 5 words to your neighbor.
Fitness trends come and go. So do so-called boutique fitness studios that specialize in one particular format. Think spinning or CrossFit.
Now with 1,000 locations and 700,000 members worldwide, Orange Theory Fitness isn't exactly the new kid on the block. They've been around for almost a decade, but they have really taken off in the past couple of years.
The workout, which changes daily, is based on high-intensity interval training, or HIIT, but it also monitors members' heart rates. That makes sure they both achieve their fitness goals, but don't overexert themselves and get injured.
Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski visited Orange Theory in Shorewood to find out more. She met with head coach Kristen Johnson and studio manager Christy Glock, and Glock explains the theory behind Orange Theory Fitness.
Orange Theory Fitness began when Ellen Lantham, she is one of the co-founders, had her own like boot camp style facility, and members wanted more. It wanted more than just yoga, Pilates, more than just weightlifting. Way back when it was, the gym was a man's game. She really wanted a bigger demographic to hit to, so that's when she developed her own type of studio and then branched out with Dave Long, who is the CEO, and they developed Orange Theory Fitness together.
So you mentioned it was very much a man's game, and I imagine there's still some trepidation when it comes to stepping into a new studio, new gym, anytime. It still has a misconception that it is a man's place or that group fitness is mostly for women and vice versa. So what do you think are the main misconceptions about Orange Theory Fitness that you would seek to disprove?
It's actually the opposite. So when Ellen first developed it, it was way back, you know, when she had original fitness profession, her own fitness studio, it was in the 70s and the 80s, where it was the big box gym, you know, weightlifting by the beach. And she wanted to give women an opportunity to be able to lift. So now on the other aspect, the biggest misconception is this is a facility and it's group fitness and it's for women only. And it's clearly not. Primarily, our membership base is majority women, but that has really changed with Shorewood over the last few years, or with our studio in the last year and other studios the last few years, by getting husbands in here, brothers, uncles, you name it. But we do have quite a few advancement with our male population. It's not a women's game here.
So can you explain to me the layout of the space? What kind of equipment is used here?
So three components to each of the workouts. We have, obviously, in the front of the studio, our treadmills, and they are specially designed for Orange Theory Fitness through Free Motion. So there is a flex deck on our belts, which makes it very joint friendly, really kind of taking out the impact of what some of the other treadmills are about, or even just the outdoor running. So that's one of the kind of neat functions to the treadmills that we have. Also, the touch screen and all the quick touch options and everything has been specifically designed for Orange Theory Fitness as well. That is where the majority of the heart rate based interval training kind of takes place up there. So when we talk about that orange zone, when people are looking to hit their minutes in that orange zone, that 84 to 91% of their max heart rate, that's typically where they're looking to rack up those minutes. We have three categories on the treadmills. We've got power walkers, we've got joggers and runners, all with their own parameters. And then anybody that might have any injuries that working through or orthopedic issues, we also have the bike and the strider as well as that option. And then back behind that is the water rowers, which is a great power component to the workout itself. When we coach people on how to row properly, 80% of the muscles in the body are working when we're rowing. No impact, so pretty much anybody can get away with working on the rower. And then one of the top three calorie burners in cardio fitness as well. And then all the way to the back of the studio is our weight floor, where we do our resistance training. Us as coaches lay out all the demos and spend a lot of our time actually coaching on the floor to make sure each member is getting the most out of each exercise and keeping themselves safe on the floor as well. And that's, again, where we're not really looking for a big heart rate response, but looking to build overall strength and core strength, core stability, and things like that.
You mentioned the orange zone, which is, of course, the big component of Orange Theory Fitness. So can you explain how the heart rate monitors are used in this class and how that's different from any other, you know, gym or group fitness class structure?
So with the heart rate monitors, when any person comes into the studio, they'll fill out their client intake form just based off of things such as age, gender, height, weight. We will be able to calculate for them their maximum heart rate. off of those percentages where we kind of divide them up, we just try to simplify it. So up on that screen will be their heart rate feedback in real time. So when they're in that green zone, which will be kind of their active recovery, their base pace or their aerobic zone, that'll be 71 to 83% of their max heart rate. 84 to 91% is when they hit that orange zone, kind of that sweet spot of trying to hit their 12 or more minutes for that afterburn. And then we'll just let people know if they ever do get up into that red zone, which will factor into the overall afterburn, but that 92% or higher, that's just letting them know that they need to check in to make sure that they're in control. Having the heart rate feedback, I think, helps people on both sides. The members find that they are very much motivated by having the heart rate feedback up there. They're able to sometimes see that they can sometimes push harder than they might have once thought before. And then also kind of gives them that little check-in point if they are up into the red zone, just knowing that, you know, that they should be checking in to make sure that they're in control. Just kind of keeping everybody accountable, but also safe in the studio. And then for us as coaches as well, just for us to see, you know, where people are at, if they're starting to feel discouraged, if, you know, they're finding that they're having a quicker recovery and maybe not getting to their minutes. It helps us see, you know, where we might be able to make small little changes to keep them making those proper progressions to continue to move forward and getting the results that they're looking for as well.
We have the three main stations here and the five zone heart rate interval training. Now, with the monitors and checking in, if someone doesn't have any experience with heart rate monitors, doesn't have, say, a Fitbit or anything else, do you think it's pretty user-friendly to be able to come into this environment and now train yourself to learn how to evaluate your own heart rates?
We would hope that that would be the case for anybody walking in here, whether they've been working out for their entire life or whether this is day one on their fitness journey. But all that is laid out for them with the first session. That's why we do have people come in 30 minutes early so we can explain how the monitors all work. We do have three different options for heart rate monitors. So whichever one people find to be most comfortable or, you know, where they feel like it reads most accurate for them. And then we'll spend that time to educate them regarding their heart rate zones, and then us as coaches as well taking that extra time after class. So we always want everybody to feel very confident, especially into their first couple classes, knowing what all that feedback means up there and what they're looking at. Depending on where people are at in their own fitness levels, coming in day one, if you've never worked out before, we're not going to expect for them or encourage them to hit their 12 minutes. It's again going to be that progression to what's comfortable, but to continue to make that their goal at some point.
So you have a workout of the day, essentially. You come in at any time. Here's your structure for the hour. Who decides this? And since it's every day, once a day, and it changes every day, do you and the other trainers work together to organize, okay, we're going to work this muscle group first and then transition to something else, because you don't want to overwork one part of the body if someone's coming in at various times of the week. So how do you decide how this goes?
So the corporate design team, they design the templates throughout the course of a month. It's not a predictable rotation by any means, but they do space it out to assume that maybe people are coming in like that 3 to 4 days a week. So it's not always going to be the same muscle group every single time. They're spaced out with the different focuses of the workouts as well. So endurance days, strength days, power days, and then other days where they're either a blend of two or all three components together. So always going to be different intervals, different exercises and muscle groups working on the floor. Also changing up the rep counts and maybe the weight selections that we might encourage for them to use as far as that goes. For the most part, with the overall weekly kind of rollout, there is a pretty good spacing in between the muscle groups and that we're coming in and working on daily basis.
So this is a studio and it's formatted as a group class, but you could argue that you're working out for your individual goals with other people. What's the benefit of this setting?
I feel like one of the misconceptions and sometimes some of the concerns of members coming in is with everybody up on that screen, they're wondering if it's competitive, but absolutely not. What that's there for is, and what the beauty of the workout is it, even though everybody's in the room doing the same workout, give or, you know, with maybe an option here to kind of working at their own efforts, their own pace. Nobody's comparing anybody, you know, with anybody else. It's a very encouraging environment. So we're a big community here. So with having, you know, some of our youngest members at maybe 14 to 16 years old, all the way up to mid 70s, just very encouraging. They find it to be very motivating having the group and the energy and the coaching aspect. But at the same time, they know that they can just kind of worry about their own efforts and what they're able to put into the workout as well.
How does this benefit you as an instructor?
So my background is I did years and years of personal training, some small group, but what I love about Orange Theory is, I mean, the absolute proven results. People come in here and I felt like, I think there was a time with personal training where you can make progress, and but when you kind of develop that relationship with your client, it sometimes can transition into that more of a social hour. So here they're coming in, they're getting after it. You have the ability to still build that relationship and kind of create that friendship with people, and then also just the members with each other. But at the same time, everybody's here just giving it their best effort for that full hour. And it's just kind of a good combination of having, I think, the relationship building, but also the proven results that people are coming in and walking out of here with, that you can see over the course of time with that consistency.
Right. Do you feel that a lot of your clientele were apprehensive about group fitness beforehand, but then they try this format and find that they enjoy being in that setting?
Yeah, absolutely. We have quite a few people in here, and we briefly spoke on, you know, the male demographic that we have in here. A lot of the men come in here and be like, oh my gosh, this is not what I expected at all. My husband has been doing it and he hates group exercise. They, I think, go back to good old fashioned aerobics. And clearly that is not what we're presenting here in the studio. That's not about the brand. So I think when people come in here, it's kind of a wake up call, and we essentially change their mind on their aspect, because it's personal training in a group fitness atmosphere. We are still giving them that one-on-one attention, but they're getting that energy and that, you know, as Kristen mentioned, the community from being in the smaller space, and just knowing that everybody's here for the same reason. And we do change their mind when they walk through the doors.
So what kind of place do you want to assert yourself in the field of boutique studios as more and more specialty studios keep popping up? How do you want to stay in a secure spot and also in a spot that stands above the others?
Sure. So boutique studio, that's in a gray area, because yes, you could by definition call us a boutique studio because we are one of a kind. However, what makes us set apart from everybody else is that we are completely science-backed. This isn't, you know, an idea that was built because somebody hated their boss and built their own studio. This is, you know, a woman who was ambitious and got a team of scientists and medical professionals and built the studio from the ground up. And this is where we've come today, with 1,000 studios open now. So I think we're going to continue advancing with the technology, whether it's updated heart rate monitor systems or updated equipment or bringing in new pieces of equipment here. It's always going to be something that's going to work through somebody's regular fitness routine, in addition to doing yoga and Pilates. This, you know, really could be their multivitamin, where they're getting their cardio and their weightlifting and, you know, just really continuing to progress their efforts in other areas of their life, not just fitness levels, but sleeping better, you know, the whole scope of more life.
So to finish off, I'm going to ask the both of you, what would you say or encourage to someone who is still a little bit hesitant to come in the door? And then what's your favorite aspect of working here and also participating in these workouts?
Boy, I'm telling somebody who never wants to come in here, number one, saying it literally is for every walk of life in here. One advantage of all of us coaches being personal trainers is we know how to accommodate every single person that walks through the door, whether they're coming off an injury or they think they're too old or they're too young or they've had this knee that's been tweaking out on them for a long time. We know how to continue getting them through their workout successfully. So giving personal experiences or sharing other members' experiences and just letting know it's okay to be scared, but you're never going to know unless you try it. And then once they get in here, the majority of the people are like, wow, you know, this is not what I expected. This is amazing. As far as me personally, I came off ankle surgery and didn't run for an entire year. And then starting back with my position here, it is drastically increased my athletic ability, shaving, you know, a minute off my per mile time, if not more, making me stronger. And then as far as, you know, the participant, and even though I'm a coach, I'm supposed to know what I'm doing, the fact that we can admit we need help from other coaches. So when we take classes, we allow other coaches to coach us, knowing that, you know, we can know everything, but there's always room for progress and advancement, even with us as coaches as well.
And then I'd say from myself, it would be, I just feel like more and more you get to know your members, you see their progress, and they truly believe that this is a place that has just been life-changing for them. So whether it's about weight loss, whether it's about going from a power walker to a jogger, whether it's somebody who's never touched a dumbbell in their life and now all of a sudden they feel very confident in the weight room, just to see all those experiences happening in front of us, but also from the feedback and just the results that people are getting from it. From my own personal experience just doing the workouts as well, being able to accomplish more than I probably ever thought. I feel like after doing these workouts for the last couple of years, I feel like I'm kind of in the best shape that I've ever been. Even going through high school and in college and always being an avid exerciser. And then also for me too, after kind of a big move from Texas coming back to Wisconsin, just being a part of this community, meeting just a lot of awesome people, members and staff, and kind of building that family and a lot of great friendships that I feel like even I worked in a wellness center for 10 years and never had that as much as I do here. So I just think, and that's something that I think is feedback that we get from a lot of people that come in the doors as well. So
definitely family oriented, and you know, they go to other studios and they're like, wow, you guys, you're just way more welcoming, and we know about the members' lives. And so I think that's part of it as well, is we pay attention, and it is more than just sweating.
Kristen Johnson is the head coach of Orange Theory Fitness in Shorewood, and Christy Glock is the studio manager. To find out more and see photos of Audrey's session, go to WUWM.com. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It's 11 o'clock, and keep listening because fresh air is next.